Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
It is the golf book that everybody is talking about. You got the U.S. Open going down on Thursday. Sean and RJ on DFW Sports Station, home of the Cowboys and Rangers, 105.3 The Fan. You've been doing a lot of homework on this book written by Armin Kataya.
Yeah, and Jeff Benedict as well also wrote it. And there's from, you know, the 2008 U.S. Open, which is Tiger's, I think, his best feat. You're going to love the influence that Jordan and Barkley had over him, his upbringing, the relationship that Earl destroyed, essentially, with Tiger's first love. It's an amazing excerpts that I've read.
Let's get into it. Armin Kataya is joining us on the buyersafety.com hotline. Armin, good morning. Thank you for the time. What type of reaction and resistance did you guys get from Tiger's team on this?
Well, pretty much what you would expect. They're not really in the business of helping anybody do anything that doesn't benefit Tiger. So, I mean, from the beginning, we reached out to them through Glenn Greenspan and Mark Steinberg, chief spokesman and Tiger's agent, to just start to engage in a conversation about the possibility of an interview with Tiger for the book. And that was in January of 2016. And in response, we got a pretty harsh email. Frankly, it was insulting in a lot of ways, given our reputations as, you know, journalists and nonfiction writers. What they said was before they would even consider any kind of interview, that we had to provide a list of questions for Tiger, but we also had to tell them everybody that we had talked to and everything that they had said to us. So essentially they were asking for the book before the book came out, and we just weren't going to do that. And then once the book did come out in March, predictably they issued a press release stating that it was a quote-unquote rehash of old news, which, if you know anything about this book, it's anything but that. And then it was filled with, quote-unquote, egregious errors, which they named nine things out of 404 pages, of which some of them we could debate at another time and place. But either they were typographical or inadvertent errors. But with Tiger's people, they would much rather shoot the messenger or attempt to do it than engage in the message of the book. And that's questions they just don't really want answered, which is, who is Tiger Woods? And, you know, what's the price of genius?
Did you come away from this liking Tiger more, disliking Tiger more? How did this whole thing change your viewpoint on him?
You know, I didn't really go into it judging. Both Jeff and I were trying to be as neutral as possible because that's just the best way to approach these kinds of projects. And there are certainly times in the book where you're awed by his talent, transcendent talent. And then I mean that in everything from the ability to make the shots like he did at 16 in the 05 Masters to, you mentioned, the U.S. Open, that putt on the 72nd hole, which, like, a 15-footer downhill riding a ridgeline that nobody in the world, you know, other than Tiger, probably could have made under those circumstances, to times when you really don't like him because, you know, he becomes so entitled and so machine-like in his relationships with people that, you know, he's hard to root for as a human being. But I think in the end, I'm much more sympathetic to Tiger. I understand Tiger much better than I did when we began this book, and I think those that have read the book feel much the same way because, you know, we saw what they wanted us to see. We certainly saw it on television with his genius, but also through the images that were portrayed in the ads that Tiger was involved with so many big-time Fortune 500 corporations. And this is just a 360-degree immersive biography. And, you know, it's warts and all, but it's Shakespearean in terms of the arc of his life.
What were the stories behind these master houses and the state in which he left them? And then your note about the PGA Tour kind of having to follow up on Tiger Trails to cover things up.
Yeah, it was, well, two things, really. I mean, that's the kind of reporting that has defined this book in terms of finding people whose lives intersected with Tiger at certain points of his life. And this is the story of Peggy Lewis, who was a woman who had rented her house to the O'Meara's, to Mark and Alicia O'Meara, for many years. And then when Tiger played in the Masters, certainly after he turned pro, he stayed there. And then when Mark would miss the cut, as he often did after winning it in 98, Tiger would stay over the weekend, as obviously he was in contention. And he just left the house a mess in times that were just destroyed. In one particular weekend, Peggy came home to find magazines on her brand new coffee table, thinking, well, that's unusual. I didn't leave any magazines, to lift it up to find cigarette burns out on the table. So that's Earl putting his cigarettes out on a dining room table and not really giving a hoot, you know, about that. And then another time with Peggy where Tiger was introduced to her after staying at her house for many years. This was in 98 after Mark had won the Masters. And Alicia says, oh, Tiger, this is Peggy Lewis. We've been staying in her house. They were at a neighbor's house where Alicia was trying to get a dress for the champions dinner. And Peggy sticks out her hand and Tiger looks at her like she's not even there and turns to Alicia and says, so what time are we leaving? And poor Peggy's got her hand hanging in the air. And all Tiger had to do at that point in time was say, oh, thank you so much for, you know, the house, we love it, nothing like that. And that's who he was at that point in time. And then just to answer the PGA question, you know, Tiger's not known as a great tipper by any stretch of the imagination. And he learned that from Michael Jordan. And, you know, your tip is essentially intersecting with Tiger in his life. And but it got so bad that PGA Tour officials would have to leave $100 bills for the attendants in the locker room because Tiger wasn't leaving any money in his locker. So it's a, you know, as I said, it's a warts and all kind of biography. And we went out of our way to praise Tiger when for his genius and things that he did on the golf course and changing the game, you know, physically, socially, culturally, racially, certainly financially. But all that comes with a price, and it comes with a personal price. And I think that's really been the heart and soul of the book, which are things that, you know, Tiger's people, frankly, as I said, just don't want out there.
Armin Katayan joining us here at 105 Through the Fan, co-author of the book Tiger Woods with Jeff Benedict. All right, I've got it. I want to ask about the influence that Michael Jordan, Charles Barkley, and the city of Las Vegas had on Tiger, and this is kind of how the womanizing aspect of this whole thing started, isn't it?
It is. That was a chapter that I pretty much reported and wrote that one singularly, where Jeff had, you know, heavily influenced in many of the other chapters. But I have a lot of friends in Vegas, and they were saying, you know, this is where Tiger would come. It was his home away from home. It was kind of a secret life for him. He stayed at the mansion, which are these 29 very exclusive villas that are behind the MGM Grand. You have to be a high roller to get in there. Tiger had a credit limit in Vegas of $1 million, which is something that only about 100 gamblers in the U.S. have that kind of limit. But he would fly in on a private plane. He would take a private car to the private entrance, to the private elevator, to the private suite. He could have stayed at the mansion and never seen the outside of that resort if he wanted to. But when he would go to Vegas, he was kind of schooled by Michael and Charles, and they were the opposite ends of the spectrum. Charles, as you guys well know, is a man of the people, and he's not afraid to leave $100 in a valet's hand for bringing his car around, whereas Michael was at the opposite end of that spectrum. But that party life in Vegas for Tiger came at a time when Vegas was changing from that sort of family atmosphere that they tried to promote to the high-end bottle service, $300 you know, bottles of vodka and stuff like that. And Tiger was, hey, man, he's young. He was in his early 20s. You know, we say we didn't want to judge. I can't even imagine what it would be like to be Tiger Woods in Las Vegas where people are falling all over you. You're still single. But after he got married in 04 to Elin, frankly, that kind of activity, particularly in Vegas, never really slowed down for Tiger.
Armin, what is your opinion on the PED rumors?
Well, that's the word or the suspicions. And I think what we did, in fact, I know what we did was the deepest reporting into that that anybody has ever done. And there's a chapter called Miracle Workers, which is really a deep dive into the influence of two doctors in Tiger's life after his major surgery in 08 on his left knee. And that was Dr. Mark Lindsay, who was the chiropractor out of Toronto, who was really the one that was keeping Tiger's body and form and function. And then, you know, more in a sinister way, I guess you could suggest, is Dr. Tony Gallia, who was the PRP doctor, who was very well known among elite athletes around the world for his ability to help you recover quickly or more quickly from injuries. And he had this cocktail of healing that he would inject specifically into tendons, joints, muscles, ligaments to help accelerate the healing after surgery. We were able to get, and this was, guys, you know, this is the third rail with Tiger's people. If you make a suggestion that he was using performance enhancing drugs and you do not have drop dead cold stalled proof, you're looking at a lawsuit. And, you know, I looked deep into this thing and I never found anything that I felt comfortable connecting Tiger directly to any kind of PEDs. Suspicions among the tour or among tour regulars, yes, but proof is a completely different thing, especially when you're dealing with an athlete. Well, and frankly, with any kind of person, I'm not going to make those kinds of allegations unless I have absolute proof. But what we did get was a declaration from Mark Lindsay, the first time anybody that close to Tiger had ever said anything publicly about the suspicions of Tiger using PEDs. And Mark, frankly, just flat out denied that Tiger had done anything. And it's a pretty amazing statement, frankly. And I won't go into it here, but if you read the book, it ends a certain chapter, And it's remarkable because Mark had his hands on Tiger probably hundreds of times. And he knows when someone's using PEDs because your body feels differently in certain places. So, you know, that's as close as we could get, and I'm really proud of the way we reported it.
Armin, was there a Earl Woods story before, you know, Tiger became, you know, Tiger and on his own on the PGA Tour that really kind of stood out to you?
Oh, my God. There's like 50 of them with Earl. I mean, you can rattle them off. But I think the fact that Earl was a bigamist that has not really been reported before, that he was married to another woman, Barbara Ann Woods, Tiger's or Earl's first wife, for 3 years about before Earl married Tita. And they had been married in New York in 1969. And Earl and Barbara did not divorce officially in California until 1972. So there's that. But I think that, to me, one of the more powerful and sort of haunting kind of images is Earl after Tiger wins his second U.S. amateur at Newport Country Club in 1995. And that's, you know, where all the creme de la creme, the men with their jackets and their crests, and, you know, it's all the Commodores of the world. And they're in this merchandise tent after Tiger wins, and Earl, as he was known to do, had a few cocktails, and Tiger was accepting the trophy, and Earl grabs it from Tiger's hand, lifts it up in the air, and says, you know, this, that, and the other thing, and Bobby Jones can kiss my son's black ass. And, you know, you can only imagine that you could heard a pin drop after that was uttered in that merchandise tent, but that was Earl. Earl was driven by a certain set of racial discrimination and issues that he had experienced in his life, and he was not afraid to play the race card when he felt like it was time to do it, or the cocktails were talking.
Armin, thank you so much for the interview. Big fan of your work for a long time. Congratulations on the book, and we'll continue to push it out there. Thanks.
All right, man. Thank you so much, guys.
Armin Katayan, the biography is Tiger Woods.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.